Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. As seen on ID Discovery's The Devil You Know, Who the Bleep Did I Marry, and Tabloid, the shocking true story of how Barbara's picket fence turned to prison bars, trapped in her twisted husband's dangerous web of addiction, abuse, and world-infamous crime. Barbara Reifel, former wife of notorious body snatcher Michael Master Marino, has appeared on Oprah, Nancy Grace, ID Discovery, and Lifetime. Never before has her raw account been laid so bare. Fairy tale shattered, deceit and danger beyond her wildest nightmares, betrayal, addiction, abuse, ultimate crime, and utter destruction beyond reason. Her riveting story is one of so many. To survive, protect her children and family, and combat the monster who was her husband, Barbara evolved. A dreamer turned badass, playing his game to the bittersweet end. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Body Snatcher's Wife, My Life with a Monster, with my special guest journalist and author, Barbara Reifel. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Barbara Reifel. Good evening.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. A very fascinating and compelling book. Let's get right to that. Tell us a little bit about who you, your background, and a little bit about where you grew up before we talk about anything else.
Oh, of course. So I was a very simple, shy kind of girl growing up in Rockland County. Well, first Brooklyn. Brooklyn never leaves me. And my family moved us up to Rockland County, you know, just for more of a, I guess, a wholesome life. When things started to get a little dicey in our neighborhood. And I was a very simple, shy girl, knew nothing of anything. And as far as the things that I experienced with him. And I don't know, I went to college, just had a very, very normal, simple life. I had aspirations to be, I'll tell you one thing. My sister, may she rest in peace. She was young. I was 14, she was 9, and I really wanted to go into the medical profession because I just wish I could have done something for her. She had died at a very young age, very, very quickly, and we believe it was from some kind of a liver disease that may have been dormant in her system. Now I think we call it hepatitis C, which is an autoimmune disease. So in any case, for me, that's where I was headed. So I went to SUNY Binghamton. I was such a smart student in school, so social life was just kind of like on the back burner, and really when I went to college I kind of discovered the social life, so I didn't do quite as well, and I also found an appreciation for my mom, so I turned into kind of steering away from the aspect of maybe becoming, you know, a cardiothoracic surgeon, a plastic surgeon, something that would help people to that degree, and said, well, I want to be a mom too. I appreciate my mom. She's been there for us for our entire life. And I sort of said, okay, well, maybe a pediatrician, maybe a podiatrist. I was hearing all these different things. And then I just always knew I had a love for writing and for my whole life. I mean, I really had a lot of accolades for writing through my schooling. And I went into journalism. So I had, after Binghamton, SUNY Binghamton for 4 years, I went out to Brooklyn. Prior to finding Mr. Wonderful, I actually was taking some journalism courses. And I try to put that together with my medical background, and I was going to become a medical journalist, transcriber, whatever the industry needed. And lo and behold, I met Michael. So a kind of everything kind of led to Michael, and my aspirations and my gears changed a little bit. So, you know, as far as those aspirations, I kind of said, well, you know, I'm working a couple of jobs. When I met him, I was at my second job. So I was a dental assistant. I was going to Brooklyn College to finish up some journalism courses, and I was working moonlighting a little bit at a tanning salon for a couple of friends that owned it in my neighborhood. So that's where I met him. And that's when the course of my life took a different turn. So do you have any questions so far?
You write about, you write about that, that your background and the neighborhood you grew up in. You also said right away that you knew never to get with a mobster. You know,
yeah.
You said right away there were cheaters, beaters, and criminals, but you were attracted. You were an attractive person.
Well,
you were fit. You ended up being in the fitness industry.
You're a
very attractive woman. Michael
thank you.
Was attractive to you as well. You were mutually attractive to each other. But tell us a little bit about this. You never wanted to get with a mobster. To explain a little bit more of your background and later about Nat and your sister-in-law. So.
Oh, of course. With Michael, I had I didn't know who he was, and I initially did not say yes to him when he did ask me out to dinner. But that's where the neighborhood in Brooklyn, that's kind of what was all around. And so, you know, my grandparents grew up in that neighborhood. They grew my mother up in that neighborhood. So, I knew a lot about it, and I didn't hear such nice things. And, you know, it's such a glamorous type of life when you look at it on the outside. But the life that you lead on the inside is not always that glamorous. So I knew, as glamorous as it may seem to certain people, and some of my girlfriends thought it was, and I didn't. So for me, I knew I was steering clear of that. And I saw it all around me. I mean, just all around me. It was something that you sort of had to dodge almost, you know, and it was, I mean, for me, it was pretty clear, especially the guys in the zoot suits, you know, the zoot suits or the sweatsuits. They'd all come in to the tanning salon or just be around town or the places we went out. And it was just very prevalent and hard to get away from. So better on the outside than the inside, you know. And another thing that I learned over, you know, just time, I guess, of living, being a Brooklyn girl, is it's you know, it's a little bit safer to have connections than be connected, so to speak.
Right.
So those were my ideas in my head, even as a young girl. So I felt protected in the neighborhood. You know, my grandparents, you know, knew people, but they were, you know, my grandmother was a Syrian Jew and my grandfather was Italian. So, you know, between the two of them, I was pretty set. But, you know, when Michael walked in, he walked in with someone who was very reputed, well reputed. And I don't mention his name because, of course, we don't do that. As a Brooklyn girl, you learn these things. So it doesn't matter who you know, you just don't speak of it. So he walked in actually holding the door for him. And I said, well, is he holding the door for him just because they're walking in together, or is that his bodyguard? Like, I was just confused of who he was, but we had an instant connection. There was just no denying anything. When our eyes met, I felt a heat rise through my entire body, like through my head, like through the roof of my head. It was just undeniable. But no words spoken, just like a smile, like hello. And I didn't know who he was. I just knew his name was Mike Marino on the card, because back then, it's so long ago that we didn't even have computers. It was all like little cards and paper. So, you know, looking at his card, his name was Mike Marino on that. That was his nickname, because his father was Marino Polishing and Plating. So he just went by Marino, even though it was Mastro Marino.
Right.
I didn't know that at first. So him walking in with him, of course, an Italian last name, you know, the gentleman who walked in, of course, that had a nice, well-dressed, nice suit was coming into tan, believe it or not. And it was such a new thing back then. I mean, you're literally speaking of over 30 years ago, literally.
Sure.
So with that, came over afterwards. He came over and started to talk to me, and I was one who just was very shy. I would not let any guy I wouldn't give any guy the satisfaction of knowing that I liked him. And it's almost like I don't know if it was a defense mechanism of not being rejected. Oh, I'm so sorry about that noise. Apologies. With that, it's sort of like a defense mechanism that I said to myself, you just never want to feel rejected. So don't ever let them know you like them. See how they feel about you, really. And he showed his hand, of course, and called me after he had left. He called me and wanted to talk. And it just turns out he was friends with the owner. I was friends with the owner. When he first asked me out, I still wouldn't say yes because I really just wanted to make sure he was not a part of that world. I just wanted to stay away from it because I could feel how I felt about him already. Just having met him, I was done. To be reassured and, kind of looking at little helpful hints, I spoke to his mom. She had said something along the lines of, they were neighbors with another, large family, quote unquote family. And the parents wanted to set Michael up with one of the daughters and she wouldn't have it because she didn't want to be a part of that world. So me hearing that from his mother was quite a reassurance that they're not really a part of that world, or at least as much as she knew. So for me, that was like a clear path of, okay, well, he was raised by his parents and is very close with his mom and that's how she feels. So I felt a little safe. So, but lo and behold, like who would ever know that he actually, his actions were, I would say, pretty much quite worse than most of the quote unquote mobsters out there, if you think about what he's done, but not to jump ahead.
Yes, not at first.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And, that's the thing about Michael is who knew, because he was the strong, silent type and he seemed like he had a wonderful family life. He was such an aspiring individual. He was president of his class for 4 years in dental school. He always stood up for other people. It was just beyond me that it came to what it came to, but he just had, I was like proud to be with him. I was like, I literally felt like so proud that he chose me. That's how I felt. Out of all the women that he could have chosen, he chose me. And, in hindsight, he was lucky to have me. So, it's funny how life kind of makes that full circle sometimes.
You write that he was a former University of Pittsburgh football player, New York University dental student, like you say, president of his freshman class for 4 years, studied to be an oral surgeon. So he didn't look like somebody from that life either. He looked like somebody aspiring. He was a very bright, intelligent, healthy person. So. And he had this craniofacial surgery practice, and his business was expanding. You saw all the good things about him, but right away when that business was expanding, what did you see? What was the first crack in sort of the facade in terms of what did you see that didn't make sense to this whole picture?
What didn't make sense to me was really when I first started to see the drug addiction. I didn't even know what addiction was. I didn't even know the word, but I saw the problem. That's in my mind back then. I said, well, he's got some kind of problem. This doesn't look right. This is a little scary. Was really when we were in the really more so when we were in the hotel room between homes. I really wasn't terribly fully alarmed when he had said we needed to move due to finances. I didn't really put two and two together, but it wasn't making full sense to me of where did all this money go, not realizing, it had to do with him him, sorry, it had more to do with him not the practice changing, so to speak. You know, he was telling me things about insurance and the office. I had no idea that it was really about maybe his habits, giving money to his assistant. Well, I call her his co-core assistant girlfriend, but that's what she was. But from what I hear, from very reliable sources, I do not defame people unless it's something that is actually from a reliable source or truth. So that's exactly what she was. But, and you know, that's as far as that, like I had no idea that things were cracking when he told me we had to move. I just said, this doesn't really make much sense. How is this? But it's his practice. It's his money. He knows the insurance, and I knew how things work, but didn't really delve too deeply. I had two young children, very young children. They were like 5 and 2, and they were my world. And, you know, starting to see things kind of change with his business habits and his dinner meetings, and, you know, those little things kind of started to add up for me. But the really pivotal moment was in the hotel room when he came in and he was completely out of his mind, and I just knew that nothing might ever be the same. He literally was not my husband. I did not recognize that man. In marriage, you start to feel, well, you're definitely just falling down those rungs on the totem pole or the ladder of importance in life. And his treatment of me wasn't fantastic. It was getting worse and worse and worse over time. And you say to yourself, well, is this really what life is supposed to be about? Do I really want to stay in this? But no. And then we talk ourselves into staying. And, you know, how could you be so selfish? It's not all about you. Fill that glass up, keep filling it up as he empties it. And that's what I was saying prior to this big crack in the hotel room. That's when his mom found him with the, you know, shooting something up in his arm. And he had told her it was for his back, and I had to handle it. And really, all these things that happened, all these things that are within the book are truth. Such truth that it's stranger than fiction, because when you imagine these things and living it, you say, how could this really happen? All these things over and over and over. And I just had someone tell me something which makes perfect sense. Cause he's known me. He's a doctor here, at NYU and, in New York City. And he had said to me, and I'll give him credit. His name is Dr. William Slater. He's been our cardiologist in our family for over 30 years. And he had said that his friend had told him something that's called the boiling frog effect. And the boiling frog effect is when you have hot boiling water and you put a frog in the hot boiling water, it immediately will jump out. It'll pop right out of there. But if you put a frog in, say, I don't know, lukewarm water, room temperature water, and you slowly boil that water, it will stay there and die. And that's sort of what happened with me, with him. He was actually referring to Michael and how he, in his own mind, when it goes, starts to go crazy, like he maybe didn't seem that crazy and that, you know, out of his mind back in his younger years, and it just got worse and worse and worse, and he just became this unrecognizable being. I don't even know if I can call him human for the things that he had done. But so that was actually just told to me, I'll say probably about an hour ago, the boiling, and it just made perfect sense. So I said to myself, I know I'm going to be speaking to you. I have to. It's just, doesn't it? Like when you think about it, it's like perfect. Mm-hmm. The boiling, I was a boiling frog.
But to give him to give him a morsel of credit, this seems to be not any kind of credit at all, but gradually you find out things. Gradually you are seduced further and further. You got to give credit to yourself. You're a strong person, but it's hard to match somebody of this caliber of deceit, deception. Again, addiction does that to a lot of people. They routinely, people can con their families for years and years and years, and then there's a breaking point where there's no going back. That's what I see in this point here. He was very, very convincing to a lot of people. So now in this, when you have this incident, when he, you drag him, his body to bed later, or you know, and what you do is you search, you look. So what kind of drugs do you find, and what else do you find? And then, as you write in the book, amazingly, at 6 a.m., Michael is ready to go to work. So tell us about what you find, and then this amazing event in the morning.
Oh, my goodness. That it was, I felt like it was like, well, everything was an out-of-body experience. So even dealing with him, my unrecognizable husband, I really felt like, you know, when you see a movie and the devil comes, I really felt like this man lying there is possessed by the devil. And when I went to search, and I'm not a sneaky person, but damn it, he made me the sneakiest little, you know what, just trying to figure out how to do things and just sneak around, skulk around, and try to find out what's really happening. I was trying to find the truth, but I had to be sneaky to do it. That's the terrible part. So I went into his bag and searched, of course, in the zippers and this and that. And I found Demerol, which is what he would put patients to sleep with, and fentanyl, which is actually considered a horse tranquilizer. And I guess he was dabbling with it. I knew Demerol was a drug he put people to sleep. Fentanyl, I've never heard of, but I had, you know, researched and found out it was, you know, a horse tranquilizer. So all of these things, of course, I'm assuming I see, you know, an open ended needle, an empty bottle, a full bottle. I see all these things in this little bag. And so, of course, assuming he took much of it. But I just really had to protect my kids. I just thought he was kind of not in his right mind and afraid if, you know, there was another woman involved because of his distance from me, kind of keeping me on the outside. I really felt like not connected with him, like completely disconnected in a way. And but still my husband. So still having the right to talk to him and have him listen to me and ask him questions and, you know, be a married couple, you know, and I really respected those vows more so, you know, that's probably why the marriage lasted as long as it did, is because I really did respect, I do respect those vows. But when I, you know, when I woke, I, of course, cradled my children, a little worried about, very worried actually, about what's going to go forward. And I just, waking up in the morning, I was afraid, I really was afraid what I was going to find. And I was blown away like a feather, like one little breath. I was like a feather. It just could have blown me away. When I saw him standing there and I saw his reflection in the mirror and he's just fixing his tie like nothing, like the Michael I always knew. And arrogant, you know, always having that cavalier, arrogant attitude, you know, brushing everything off. I used to call him the minimizer. Over the years, I called him the minimizer because everything was like, nah, that's nothing. And again, like that was the beginning of it. That was the first of him minimizing what was going on and just brushing it off. And he just left and just left me there. And I was just in a state of shock, I think. I didn't even know how to go forward. I didn't even know what was in front of me. So, and I was shocked that he showed up for dinner that night. You know, he did agree to it, but I really didn't expect him to show up. So in moments with him, I would be shocked at his insane behavior. And then I would be shocked at him actually showing up for things or standing up for whatever he was saying. It's almost like a bipolar, psychosociopathic, diabolical. I mean, there's so many words I can use for him. Go on and on. But
Sorry. What was his parents' role in this? what does Dad have to say, and what was the kind of relationship they had? What was the kind of things did he say to his son?
Well, I mean, as far as this drug thing, they couldn't imagine. I was really basically trying to just calm them. His father was quiet in the beginning. When we were at the hotel prior to moving into our home, they just stayed with us, helped with the kids. We were very close with both our sets of parents. I mean, Michael really did love my parents, and I loved his. So we called each other's parents mom and dad, which these days I'm not quite sure if that's still the case all the time, but for us it was. So his mom, she's one of those crazy Italian mothers. That's all I could say, you know. She could be mad at me for it, but, yeah, she was a little Lulu. She was more of like kind of a head in the sand, didn't really want to accept or see anything that might be bad. So when I told her that her son was taking this for his back, he probably couldn't see his friend, so he was taking something to help the pain from, you know, his football injuries from his back.
Right.
You know, honestly, going forward a little bit, I know damn well that there's just no way that in his mind when he took that it was for his back. He was very good at excuses. So, you know, knowing how much of a liar he was, when I think back to the things that he had told me over time, I definitely refute much of it.
Right.
You know, I don't refute all of it. You know, I'm pretty sensible where you can't suspect everything is, you know, definitely a lie or in a negative way. So, and we did have his good points and strong points. And I would say some of the things he's taught my children, you know, the time he did have time with them, some of the things he taught them were good ethics in a way of how to treat people, which is another oxymoron. But going back to this time with his parents, I mean, they seemed to just kind of be quiet. They were quiet about it. His father was a quiet man, but definitely aware, and I think just afraid of what the very next step was. And I think, you know, as things had progressed and we had moved into the home, that's when his father needed to speak up, and that's when he did. When I called him, you know, when Michael was down to his office with the needle in his arm in the bathroom, which at that moment, did I know that his assistant was with him in that bathroom and fled? No, I didn't know she was there at first for quite a while. Nobody would tell me. But of course, we know the wife was the last to know things. So really, you know, in that moment, what could I do? I was frantic. There are just so many little details to all of this. But the bottom line is he showed his face. The big crack, that was a big crack, because it was not only to us or me to see that something's off and something's wrong. What is it? How far is this going to go? Is he going to get a hold of himself? He did this in the office. He did this during his practice when he has patients.
Right.
That's serious. He drove off. He woke up from whatever stupor he was in. Still, I would say probably pretty stupored from the drugs, and just ran through everybody and took off in his car, which, again, is a dangerous thing. So for me, listen, I may have an S somewhere under the layers of my skin here, but in my mind, I knew when to ask for help. It was instinctive. I called his father. I was not going to do this alone, and I knew he listened to him. Although his father was very diminutive to him, you know, he was a much smaller man. Michael was 6'3", over 200 pounds. His father was shorter than me, and I'm 5'8". And I knew he listened to him, but I never saw the strength come from his father that I did when I was at the stairs and saw him looking up at him, smacking him in the head, telling him what he's got to do and not do, and that he was ready to take Michael's family away from him if he doesn't get a hold of himself. And the thing is that there was so old world Italian that they didn't know from these things. They really didn't. And, you know, people are starting to come around, so it's a little noisier. I'm so sorry. Is that okay? Can you hear the background noise too much?
It's okay. It's
are you okay?
Okay.
It's okay?
Fine.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Oh, my God. So that, to me, that was the first moment. Do you want? Can I ask you a question? Is this something where I can walk away and find a quieter place? Do you mind, or just keep going?
Go ahead. Sure.
Go ahead, okay. Should I leave?
Yeah, just leave the room.
It's really quiet. It's really quiet.
We'll continue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Oh my God. Thank you so much. Is it for me? Oh, okay. Oh, it's louder. Oh, Dan, I gotta move because they're gonna start. They're blocking it off, and I'm in a quiet place right now, but it's going to become noisier. Okay, I'm so sorry. All right, so I will continue to talk to you as I'm walking.
What we didn't really explain for the audience is that what we were explaining is that he has a business partner. Your husband has a business partner, Keith. Keith calls you and says, "What's going on?" And that leads to the entire family and everyone knowing that about your husband's problem, and it's getting much worse. What you write about as well is that involved with this addiction too is when you do confront him, and you're more and more feisty in terms of your refusal to put up with this kind of behavior. He lunges at you. He assaults you. He is physical with you. But then,
yes,
very interestingly, he is very remorseful, or at least he says he's remorseful soon after. So it's this kind of erratic, more and more erratic, violent behavior, seemingly based around his addiction and his need for those drugs. And at the same time, his business, his reputation is in deep peril, let alone the relationship he has with you and your two boys, your two sons.
Yes. Yeah.
How old are your sons at this time? Tell
at
us their
time,
ages.
At this time, Michael he's 25 currently, and Jerry, although he likes to be called Gerald sometimes, but I will always call him Jerry for the rest of his life, Gerry, by the way, he is 22, and they're both doing very well. They're both as adjusted as possible, really, I think. And Michael was much more greatly affected than Michael, no doubt. So, I can't describe it. There, Michael, my oldest, is still evolving from all of this because I think that he has felt like the great protector for so long. And Jerry just is a different personality. He does not, he just basically doesn't want to, how can I put it? He says in really simple terms that, you know, I have my mom, I have my brother, I have family, I'm okay. What is there to be mad about? You know, so he just goes about his life. And he's there for us, but they're both in their own way. And they have I can't say they don't take anything from their father, but I would say that what they've done is actually take the best parts of both of us. And I'm very, very fortunate. You know, people say that they're a testament to me. I'm a testament to them. But, you know, it's just making it through. It's just, that's the thing about this whole story is just making positives out of negatives. And, you know, that's really what I want to do is just make the positives out of the negatives of life. Because, you know, what I go through or what I've been through or what I'm still going through, I mean, people go through this all the time in different ways. So if you could just take some of this, bring it forward in your life to find the strength to either get through it, get out of it. You know, there's just so many things that I've learned that I just want to kind of share and open up and make sure that sometimes it's unavoidable. That's the thing. So sometimes when these things are unavoidable in your life, like the boiling frog, you just want to know how to navigate the best you can. And, you know, it's finding the strength within yourself. Like people say, I don't know how you could do it. Of course you can. You could find that within yourself. You think you can't, but everybody's got that within themselves. You can find it. So,
Let's get to the more serious things that you do go through, because we have only begun to share with this audience some of the things, the depths that your husband does go in this addiction and in this life of criminality, basically.
Yeah.
We talked about his deteriorating business with his partners, and he's banned from every office. So he's banned from every office because he's basically shooting up in the office while a patient is under anesthetic, ready for surgery, for oral surgery. So none of these people, with their insurance or just for the safety of their patients, they do not want to deal with him. He cannot be working in any office. So what does he see as a solution? He thinks he's a very bright guy, and there's very many examples where he tells people how bright he is. So what does he do?
Right.
What does he do?
The first time he actually, he went away to rehab for, 3 days, a whole 3 days. So he basically appeased his partners and all of his affiliates, you know, all the New York, Rockland County, New Jersey, and he appeased all of them and said, oh, yeah, I'll go to rehab. They said, you're not coming back into the offices until you show us that you are clean. And he would take the urine tests, and he went away for – he was really supposed to go away for longer, I am absolutely certain. We've always heard 28 days, right? 3 days does not constitute nearly 28 days, but in Michael's mind it did, because he really and truly at that time didn't really get it. He felt like he was smarter than all those people, as well as the doctors, because he was a doctor himself. And I'm going to say it's somewhat of a God complex, where, you know, that's what's equated with doctors many times, not all the time, but a God, sort of God complex, because they actually have, you know, people's lives in their hands. And they have that knowledge and that, and I'm going to say power. They have the power to heal. They have the power to hurt. So power to do whatever they want. And that's sort of, Michael found the right profession, because he really did feel like he could do whatever he wanted. He went to rehab. But I was hoping it did something for him. And, of course, that always seemed to crack after a short time. So after 2 weeks, he was using again. And, you know, I would say within a year and a half, he was in 4 rehabs. And the last rehab, going forward a little bit, was really the most successful. Not really of his, I'm going to say not of his character or nature, but at least of the addiction. You know, it's supposed to help it all go forward and rise above, but, you know. He was just a very different individual. But, yeah, that was his first step, was to appease all of his business associates to allow him to continue with them. Because, honestly, he was a moneymaker. That's why everybody believed all along in any of his businesses that he could make the money he did, because he had that capacity. So really, they couldn't wait for him to get better. The ideas that he had for business, the production that he made in business, they just thought he was brilliant. So they were waiting with bated breath for him to get himself together. Like, shake it off, Mike, let's go. Let's do some business, you know, that kind of thing. For me, I was like, I was in a different place. I was just afraid. But the one thing I will tell you about, and of course, everyone's names are changed there. So, you know, Keith is not really Keith, and Kevin's not really Kevin. But the brothers shared with me something they had gone through with their own mom. And that, to me, that was one step for me in my process and all of this of learning. I didn't even know how much I was learning at that moment, but I tucked it away. But it made me realize that they really do want to help any way they can. It's not all about business. And they shared with me, and they said that they would be there for me. And it just so many little facets to all of this in his journey and my journey, just parallel, you know, me dealing with him and the steps he took. And I just really wish that he just didn't go so down, just plummeting down. And I just try to drag myself up constantly up, you know, just kind of rise above the things he was doing or deciding or his decisions. It just, you know, I was always trying to, and listen, nobody's an angel. I'm no angel either. He put me to places in that journey that we haven't even gotten to yet.
Yes.
I have made decisions that I could have truly hurt someone, you know, but not jumping ahead too much. Bottom line is they did take him back. You know, after he went to rehab for 3 days, I saw him going to work every day and coming home to us, having dinner. The boys were still young. They were, like I said, 5 and 2, 6 and 3. And so he was back on track for a minute, a couple of weeks. You know, and his path over the months, he just couldn't get a hold of himself. You know,
right.
And at that time, I still did not know 100% yet about that moment. I still was not exposed to that. I did not have the proof. Did I suspect? Yes. But do we break up a marriage from a suspicion? Usually not. You know. Many times people don't even, you know, leave after they do know. So,
right.
Yeah. But,
let's use this as an opportunity, Barbara, to stop for a second to just talk about our sponsor, which is Audible. Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, from bestsellers to celebrity memoirs, news, business, and self-development. Every month, members get one credit to pick any title, plus 2 Audible originals from a monthly selection, and access to daily news digests from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, as well as guided meditation programs. Audible membership lets you download titles and listen offline anytime, anywhere. The app is free and can be installed on all smartphones and tablets. You can listen across devices without losing your spot. If you can't decide what to listen to right now, you can keep your credits for up to a year. Not only does Audible have thousands of audiobooks, but also podcasts, guided wellness programs, theatrical performances, A-list comedy, and exclusive Audible originals you won't find anywhere else. I use my Audible credits to choose The Billionaire Murders by Kevin Donovan, and incredibly, narrated by Kevin Donovan. The Mysterious Deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman from Toronto, incredible. Yes, mysterious to say the least. The Billionaire Murders I was really looking forward to, and luckily it's narrated by Kevin Donovan, the author. I also bought A Checklist for Murder, true crime classic, and it's been featured on True Murder before, the true story of Robert John Piernock. And again, Anthony Flacco, the author, incredible author, narrated by Anthony Flacco. So talk about getting the voice of the author. So Audible provides that. Visit audible.com/truemurder or text truemurder to 500-500. Visit audible.com/truemurder or text truemurder to 500-500. Now, Barbara, you talked about, we've been talking about this deteriorating, ever-increasing drug addiction of Michael's that's impeding his business completely and his life absolutely. What are the circumstances in which he now cannot work with any of these people and comes up with a plan to make money utilizing his skills and something called tissue harvesting? I know you didn't know much about it. You didn't want to know much about it, but what happens? What are the circumstances in which he has to shift gears and turn to a different, completely different aspect of the medical industry?
Well, It's funny you say that when I was mentioning about like all the rehab. So after his last rehab, it was 3 months long. And after that, he really and truly seemed to have a hold on recovery. And there was a moment where it sounded like, or it actually looked like he did slip, and I left for a couple of weeks. It was pretty intense situation, and I did end up coming back, and that's when he was trying to find himself, reinvent himself. He told me he wanted to keep a low profile, which it's hard to do as Michael, because when he walked in a room, he was quite a presence. And you know, I sort of just took every step very slowly. I still didn't trust him as a husband. I was trying to rebuild the trust. There were so many different parts of this, but for him in a business, he did ask me about going back into oral surgery, that he could get his license back, et cetera. And I said, well, why would you want to risk your life and others by having drugs? He said, I could have somebody hold the key. I can ask them for the key for the drugs. And I said, really, Michael? I mean, really? So if you really want those drugs, you think you can't get them, they're going to hold that from you? He's just that personality where he acts accordingly. So with that, he said, I'll listen to you. And I said, well, you should not go back into oral surgery. I don't know what you're going to do, but you should not go back into oral surgery. You should not be handling live people and drugs and things that can hurt you and them. So he didn't. But this new business, it seemed to evolve. I remember him talking about something with hospitals and ambulances, mentioned little things. I think he just, I don't know if it was a cover, because at the time he was still cheating on me and I didn't know that, but I did sense it. I just thought that maybe it was my insecurity, of course. But with this business, he actually found that, I guess, that little niche with funeral homes. And it sounded like everything was legitimate. It sounded like he was just doing everything the right way, really trying. He said, you know, I found something. This can really help people. He sounded so excited about it. He had an office within our rental at the time. It was a duplex rental. And it all sounded creepy. And he asked me to tell everybody he was doing research, because really it just sounded, how do you tell people? Oh, I harvest bodies. I take tissue from dead people. Like you don't just go and have like a light conversation about it. You know, everybody's nosy, you know, the community and the parents, parents of our friends, you know, of our kids' friends, everyone. It's how do you have a conversation? Because everybody wants to know what everybody does. It was that kind of community. Everybody talked. So with that, Michael does research. I didn't even tell everybody that he was a drug addict for a long time, but of course everybody tends to find these things out. But with the new business, he started in a lab that he just kind of set up in the basement. No, I'm sorry. Right off of the basement, the garage. He was in the garage, actually, because it was not a large place, you know. So he had a freezer. He did his office work up in the bedroom that we didn't use. He used that as an office. Everything sounded legit. He had an attorney come to the house, and he didn't talk to me. I met him, and I don't even remember his name, but I remember him saying, Barb, and it was another guy, Nick. I forgot Nick's last name, but it was another guy, Nick, that he had there for a reason to listen with the attorney. I'm not quite sure what his role was, but Michael told me this. He's going to show us exactly how to do this the right way and take the proper steps. So these are the things I'm hearing. So it's almost like it's something new. We want to learn how to do this the right way. We don't want to do anything wrong. So let's just make sure we start and go forward. That's the way it sounded to me, you know. So I didn't think anything of it, but not really realizing that he was that diabolical and that calculated in every aspect of his life, of lies here and lies there, and to this one, to that one. You know, it's just quite amazing to me how he operated. He had, I used to call him Spidey Brain, you know, in the latter years when he was in trouble for this. And he just had so many of these ideas he put down on a chart and would just literally fly off the chart. It was just like when you have an endless web that forms and it just goes into oblivion, that's kind of how his brain worked. And, you know, where did this go? He had this meeting with his attorney to learn what? How he was going to fool everybody? What was the meeting really about? I have no idea. But obviously, that's what they did. He and his partner, Joe Nicelli, from the very beginning, I don't really even know all the details of how many people were actually good donors out of all of this, of you know, procuring tissue for the sake of research and transplant to help people, not hurt them. It just seems he always found a profession where he, like, my aunt always says, and we call her Aunt Mimi. My Aunt Mimi always says that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And in Michael's case, it truly was every single time. He had, what did he do? He had a oral surgery practice, craniofacial surgery. He had hands of gold. He was known to have hands of gold across the entire country, even on the West Coast, even in China, even in Italy. He had hands of gold. He was like a golden child. It was amazing. And what did he do with it? It went down the crapper, you know? And as far as, you know, this as well, I mean, the magnitude, I mean, his idea to do good grew, but then his monstrosity, the monstrosity within him grew as well. I mean, I could have never imagined in a million years that I would be talking to you about this, about my ex-husband, not the man that I had a happy life with and lived happily ever after with children, with the white picket fence, and that it came to all of this. I would never have ever dreamt of this, had a nightmare about it, or conjured it up to write a book.
Right.
So, yeah. So that's where the birth of his new business had begun, and he seemed to have had a crew, and he said he was training this person, that person. I don't even know where he got these people from. He would still go to his what's it called when you parole. He'd go to his parole office,
right?
Because of course, you know, backing up for a moment when he got arrested, when he was with his assistant and he had possession of cocaine and Demerol, and they had the car accident. They ran the truck right into a telephone pole in front of my children's elementary school in a new neighborhood. So from that, he was still going. So he has this new business. He's going to his parole officer, and I'm just keep going along life. If I took a step back from my life, I don't quite know what I really would have done if I really assessed things. My parents were always supportive of me. They were just always there. So my parents never wanted to lose me. So they always, you know, and just support. They were always very supportive. They told me how, they never ever tried to tell me as an adult what to do. They never told me, you need to leave him. They just were as supportive as they could. They were there for my children. And they couldn't have been the best, any better parents. I had the best parents in the world. And I am the person I am today because of them and got through it. So, you know, when I look at everything around me and I look at him in the path, I'm living this life with him. I can't even imagine what my family was thinking. I know they didn't know everything at the time because I didn't tell them everything, but, you know, we have sense about things. I mean, and you know what I say about Michael? I say about Michael that with me, with him, as smart of a person as I was, whether it was book smart, whether it was becoming a sleuth, whether it was anything I had evolved or developed into
because of him, always so, like, just too close to see what was in front of me. It was too close. You know when they say you're too close to see?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was living. You know?
When we talk about the tissue, there was a criteria, and there was rules, obviously. What was the potential harm? I mean, your husband didn't get an infamous reputation from doing legitimate tissue harvesting. What were these people doing? And he called these people that assisted him, that he recruited. They were called cutters.
Yes.
So what was the reality, and why was he depicted as a ghoul when the facts came out? Interesting in the book, too, when he's first talks of maybe potential indictment, of course he, again, the sociopath that he is, that he's completely innocent, they just want to talk to me, and then it evolves into, well, they're likely going to make an arrest. Till you find out what I just asked you, what are some of the things that he was involved with, allegedly, and then later proven to be involved with?
Well, what he did was, which I, of course, did not believe that he would do these things, given his second chance at life after addiction, he actually forged everything. He forged, and I say everything across the board because I think there were very few of the forms that were not forged in some way. So it was forgery, fraudulent information. When someone would die, okay, someone would pass away, the body would be at the funeral home, and I guess they would be in cahoots with what they were going to do, how they were going to, what team was going to go, what they were going to do, what they were going to falsify. I'm not quite sure because I wish I had more detail, but I'll tell you what I know is that they had all this information. So they forged whether it was the illness that they did or didn't have. Say if they had AIDS, they would put down asthma, okay, just for instance.
Right.
They would change the date of birth, so it was a younger age to fit that the perfect criteria for tissue. When they expired, so maybe it extended the time of the tissue being viable, you know,
right.
Whether it's, and when I say tissue, just to be a little more specific, I don't know all of the list of things it was, but from what I understand, it's everything but organs, meaning it's not eyes, it's not the heart, but it's heart valves. It's tendons and stuff in the knee. I think they called it knee patella tendons, skin, bone, things of that nature, stemming from organs for function.
Right.
So that kind of stuff. And of course, I know this because I was a biology major and I was going for, you know, pre-med. So I have kind of a background, like knowing these things when I speak. I just hope everyone understands what I'm saying about, you know, the different tissue. So it wasn't actually like eyes and heart, that type of thing. It was, or let's say a gallbladder or a liver or things like that. It was really more of the, you know, the extending type of things in a human body, the bones and things. So that's really what he was taking. But these patients died. These people died. They were sick, old. The tissue maybe was a little bit older, meaning, say, not refrigerated. Excuse me, maybe not refrigerated properly, or, you know, for extended amount of time. Like once someone dies, there's only a certain amount of time that you can preserve that tissue. So until they get into dry ice or whatever the process they do with it. So I think that was a factor that was changed. Just a lot of different things, but really the most gruesome part of this, which has actually changed the laws, is that he saved whatever, I guess, few donors that he had, right? I don't know numbers, but he had, say, a few donors that were good and viable. He would save that blood, I guess, probably every ounce, because he had so much bad tissue, from what authorities were saying, that he would send a small sample of the blood to, say, with a number on it, and he would send it to one of the labs. I know one of them was LifeCell, one of them was RTI, Regeneration Technologies Institute. He used to work with them when he was an oral surgeon. So with that, he would send for approval for the tissue to send for sterile technique or whatever else they were going to do there. And he would take a diseased tissue that I had come to learn that the bags of tissue in my tandem garage, my third garage in a freezer, right, was not for quote unquote research, but was the diseased tissue. That now I know why he insisted, because he said it was for research. I have to keep it separate. I said, why can't you leave it at your lab? And we had a big fight about it. And that's why, because of course, at that time, I didn't realize he had tissue with my kids' basketballs in the same garage. But what he did was send the good blood for a sample with a number. He would take a piece of bad tissue, whatever that was going to be for that sample or order or whatever they call it, and he would match up the numbers. And the two did not have anything to do with each other. So he basically was matching up good blood with bad tissue as he sent it to the processing companies. And what that did, of course, was approve bad tissue, which was, bad tissue was precluded with, that causes a big recall of tissue where people could have gotten sick. But whatever that was used for, if it was used for transplant in any way, that's where people could possibly get sick, because it's under the guise of good, healthy tissue for transplant. Meanwhile, it was diseased. So they found out all of this through forensics during the case. And I don't know who else knew anything, but obviously they found out through however they did. I mean, they confiscated his records. I don't know how they put all the pieces together, but they knew everything. And he didn't know they knew everything. So when, he didn't realize they were playing with him. The bottom line is first of all, they didn't even know. They didn't even really know what they were going to find. They actually found a treasure trove when it came to Michael, because they thought that they were really just looking into Joe Nocelli for, at the time, initially, I think, from what I understand, for duping the families out of some kind of money or insurance or something or other. So whatever that was, it was about that. And then when they came there and spoke to this new couple that Joe Nocelli was in partnership with this funeral home, that's when Pandora's box just blew open, and they had a big treasure in front of them of like, oh my God, we hit it big, like that type of thing. Like, look at what is this good room? Like all these different things were going on, and it just blew up. So it didn't start out that way, but they found one of the biggest cases that they could have ever found. Sometimes you never know what kind of treasure you find along the way. And for them, that was, and it was. And you know what? I'm glad that they did, because at first Michael was making the DAs and the authorities out to be the bad guys. They were trying to get him, and he did nothing wrong. And there was a bigger fish, and they're trying to squeeze us and squeeze to get to him. And he had all these different manipulative stories, and we loved him, and even his attorney, who's known him his whole life, believed him. Right. We all believed him, and damn, he was good. he was truly one for the books, no doubt. So he definitely fooled us along the way that's what he did. He switched. Those are the terrible things that he did that made him the ghoul that he was. And over 1,000 bodies, thousands of families, incredible. Whether it's thousands of patients. Think about across the whole world. He was thought of as king of tissue for a while. So king of tissue, everybody was clamoring to get his tissue. And they didn't realize that they were going into like a poison pot, you know? So that's where all the recalls came from. So unfortunately, every time I think about it, I get really upset because, you know, then I think about that. You know, my story, I was side by side with this monster and I had no idea. And I look at how everybody was affected by him and all the terrible things that he's done. And to me, it really can't compare. What I've gone through, I can't compare to what they have to live with for the rest of their lives from this stranger, from when they actually thought that they were getting medical help. They were having an answer, whatever it is. It was an answer to a prayer of getting tissue to solve whatever health issue they had. And that's what they got from him.
Right.
So that kills me. But it's, you know, of course I know it has nothing to do with me. The only thing I think of sometimes, Dan, is that when, you know, back in his drug days, there were a couple of times where, and I mean, it's in the book, where, you know, I won't say I saved his life, but I kind of helped him along with breathing. Drugs were really taking over. But back then, really, who knew what a monster he would become? He was just, you know, a sick man. Maybe not terribly the greatest husband or father at that time, but a sick man. And I basically put him on his way to saving his own life. And I didn't realize the monster he would become. And some people might argue that maybe I should have, it's always shoulda, woulda, coulda. Like I should have let him just, you know, die. And that's not really what I'm all about. So I struggle with things like that. Like I can't regret anything. But when I think about the masses that he hurt, it makes me think, you know, we always do that. Whenever somebody else does something wrong, we're like, what could we have done to stop this? Like, what could we have done? I didn't know. So how could I have stopped it? So, you know, that's a big question people have had for people I've known over the years is, could she have known? If you put me on under a lie detector test today, I will still pass. I did not know anything. The one thing I did suspect is maybe he, after like everything came out, maybe he knew about something. But he was something else. He truly, I don't feel so much alone because he did fool the whole world, anybody that was in his presence. I don't really know even about his workers, his cutters. And I mean, I'm assuming they had to maybe have known something. I don't know if they did or they didn't. I don't think people go to jail for nothing. That includes his co-core assistant girlfriend that he had running his Rochester operation up in Rockland County.
Right.
Excuse me, not Rockland. Excuse me. It's Rochester. I live in Rockland County. but in any case.
You write about how big this business was, and then you talk about this Helena, and you do have colorful language for the emails that you send, all because you discover these other women as well as Helena.
Yes, yep.
But Helena, yes. You have is somebody that very interesting part of this. Maybe you can tell us about your friend Nat and the offer she made to help you with the problem of Helena.
Yes. Okay. Well, Helena goes back to, and I'm going to say this. I'm just going to preface this with, you know what? Helena is just a symbol of what he did. Okay. Because even though she did serve her time and whatever else, she was just a part of who he was and what he did. If it wasn't her, it would be someone else. Okay. So that's, you know, I'm just going to say that. So, you know, as far as crucifying people, you know, we can't crucify in this life. It's not my place to let the authorities do it or let God do it. But okay. So, and I know that's the thing. I almost tried to play God, which I took back, but in all of this, having a very dear family friend, Nat, who I will say, as we talked about, mob connections, this is a connection, and she loved me. She loved Michael. She was, she represented something that you usually don't see in that world, where she had more power than I think any other woman has ever had in that world, and still does. But in any case, she loved me so much. She loved my children, and she even loved Michael, but she was so angry with him. She actually tried to convince me to cheat just as much as I could, but that's just another part of it. But this part, she had said, you need to, she said, you know, when life, basically what I said, when life's a bitch, you know, she had told me, either you know, life's a bitch, and then you know, might have to get rid of one. You know, the bottom line is, you know, little old me from like Brooklyn and Rockland County didn't know from addiction, didn't know from violence, didn't know from all that he was showing. Michael was just showing me the world, wasn't he? She had said, if you want him to, your father, the father of your children, if you want the father of your children to survive, she has to go. And I thought of myself as a wife, and what my husband was doing with her, and the obsession that he had with her, with the drugs, that they were so intertwined, and that, you know, my kid's father is flailing. He's just spiraling down and just destroying everything around him. So I'm thinking, well, you know, she's got a point. If we get rid of her, she's just trouble. Like, that's, you know, in my mind, I'm not thinking my husband's so much trouble. I'm thinking that she's trouble. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, get rid of her. You know, Fran had a whole plan. Nat had a whole plan. And I even hate talking about this because it's such a part of me that it's not in my being to even think this way. So yes, for a moment, for a couple of moments, I thought, okay, she's going to make a plan, and we'll just do it by overdose. It's easy, whatever, you know, she'll be gone, and Michael will be fine. Right. So I'm thinking of all this, but you know, I do it in a certain way in the book where it like almost happens. It looks like it's going to happen. I hate to give it all away, you know, but it looks like it's going to happen. But of course, you know, in a moment of clarity, I'm like, what am I even thinking? I because of Michael, I actually became insane. Listened to someone in a world where that was just normal. That was a normal occurrence, like nothing. Like, you know, if you got to get rid of somebody, get rid of them. That's not my world. That's not how I operate. And who am I to play God? And on top of that, if it wasn't this Helena, of course her name has changed, it would be someone else. Right? So if it's not one, it's going to be another. You know, it's in my mind, I'm thinking, what am I thinking? And I literally stopped the plan. I mean, there was a moment, I have to say, that I was like, oh my God, oh my, like almost a sense of relief was coming of, oh, excitement. Everything's going to be okay now. How could I think that getting rid of someone would make everything okay? You know? So I kind of got a hold of myself, but it was, would I have ever thought of that in my life if I wasn't married to Michael and dealing with him? No, absolutely not. If it wasn't, you know, she put the idea in my, not put the idea in my head. Yes, she did. But it was almost like I felt lost, and she found something that was going to, that sounded like it was going to solve the problem. But yeah, but no. So, you know, as far as apologies, the only thing I could do is say, I'm sorry. In my own mind, I'm sorry for even thinking that, you know, it was what it was at the time, but I didn't think it was ever, I don't think it would have ever happened. I don't think I could have ever let it happen, but there was a moment where I was just enamored by the idea, which is kind of scary, where you take yourself in desperate times.
Yeah, certainly.
You know?
Now, this was a huge story in the media.
Yes.
And the media acted accordingly, basically imprisoning you in your home so that you have to take your boys and try to, and that's your big deal, to protect your boys from all of this, if you can, especially the media.
Yes.
Now, the courts took this very, very seriously. The media could take something seriously, but the court took this very, very seriously. He gets out on bail and acts even more erratic. He's making crystal meth in the basement. It's you find out through his AOL account that there's other women. You find out later that he basically used you, conned you to get you to sign documents, and now you owe a lot of money. So you are beyond disgusted, beyond finished with this man. But then there's the court case and the sentence. What happens at court? What kind of sentence does he receive?
I wasn't there for the actual sentencing, but he had gotten 25 to 75 years,
right,
in New York. I think that they had given him, I think, parole, an option for parole at 12 years, but nobody ever thought that was really going to happen because forgive me, I just got away from people from noise and now they're following me. I apologize. So anyway, as far as
In essence it was a life sentence for him? Is that what it would seem?
Yes. 25 to 75 years was a life sentence. And I'll say, because it was his first offense, they called it, they did give him some kind of leniency where it was going to be more like 25 years, but they put that down to 12, it looked like. But the other part of this is, I believe Brooklyn and Philadelphia were working together in this, where I think they were all working together in this. Like, you know, I learned a lot over the years. So I think what was going on, because I'd say, why, when he was in so many places, why wasn't it federal? It was all state. It was the oddest thing. Usually when you're in a bunch of different states, it's federal. But I think what they were trying to do was actually try to make sure that if he wasn't getting enough time in one place, that they were ready to try him in another place. Like they were kind of holding back their indictments. In case, and I didn't really get that at that time. I'm like, what? You know, people are like, why isn't it so many places? Like, why isn't it federal? And I didn't really know, but I, you know, learning things over the years, that definitely must be the reason. So he had gotten 25 to 75, 12. Now, Philadelphia is actually a commonwealth. So he was going to get minimum 25 years there anyway, from what I understand. So after the 12 years, he would have been transported to Philadelphia for the other 13 years. So at 49, he would have been, I guess, you know, 80 or thereabouts.
Sure.
You know, but I don't think they would have ever let him out. I think that, you know, there are people still today that I can't blame them. I truly believe if he was still alive today, that they would be at every parole hearing, making sure he never got out. And if it was my family, I would say I'd probably be one of those people. So things happen the way they're supposed to happen. And unfortunately, I can't take blame at all for what happened. I can't take back taking him back or saving his life, or anything, or even supporting someone I didn't know was so terrible. You know, I mean, I was there for him. And the moment that I found out he did everything wrong in that DA's office, everything changed. I knew he had cheated because of course, I found that all that out, and I sent every one of his women, let's call them, all of, I made a file for each one of them from the other emails, because back
right.
then, you know, so media was very different, and communication was different. It was a long time ago. So really, sent them all each other's information, you know, all the little love notes and sex notes and all that kind of fun stuff. So they all had
yeah.
some nice reading material, and I sent it all to him when he was in the hole in Philadelphia, in like a little box with a tiny little window, and let him think on it, you know. And, you know, I couldn't have been a more supportive wife. And at that point, after I found everything out, I knew what I needed to do. I knew I needed to separate myself as far away. I needed to divorce him completely, which was one of the most liberating, relieving, happiest days of my life. And I needed to protect my kids. And it's such an all-encompassing journey. There's so many parts to it. And I'm sorry if I've been tangenting sometimes, but
okay.
it's pretty broad. So, and he was a pretty broad mind, and that's the sad part. You know, somebody like that who was always deemed, I'll just say, kind of not too smart in school, brought himself up and thought he was going to be smarter than everyone. He was going to show everyone how smart he was. And, and he was a little too smart for his own good. He could have used it for good and intended on it, or just at least looked like he intended on it. You know, crazy people like that, do they really know how terrible they are? I wonder that. Do you ever wonder that? Because you're in, you know, True Murder and all of these different stories. Do you ever wonder, do they really know how absolutely horrendous, just disgrace, just terrible people that they are, inhumane, like subhuman behavior.
I think they've justified their behavior for so long, and other people have enabled them, that I don't even blame other people, but they've justified it long enough that they do believe their own nonsense, and also they seem oblivious, just like they've been oblivious
right.
to people's feelings and the hurt. They're oblivious to the magnitude or the harm, are always. And your book is a prime example. What we haven't told, and because this would be another interview, would be the strength that your sons had in this, because it must be incredible to discover your father was a loving father, is considered a ghoul and also an
yeah.
adulterator, and then somebody that in the end didn't care for their welfare, but yet had to say in his dying days that I did this all for you, boys, my sons.
Right.
But this journey is quite a bit of that protective strategy you had for your children, for your boys to grow up and realize the truth and then be able to process
yeah.
it and then accept it and then become the fine gentleman that they are today.
Yes, thank
despite,
you. Thank you for that.
Despite this.
Yeah, and so, I will tell you, you know, that's a very fine line as a parent when something like this is happening of how much, and I've shared this with others that have gone through things, of how much you share with your kids as you're going through this, at what age. So in my mind's eye, when I was going through this, seeing the struggles that my older one, Michael, had when he was probably 10, 11 years old, 11, 12, the bottom line with how I handled it with him is sharing with him and making sure he knew there for him. And I will make sure he is aware of what he needs to be aware of. And if he had some questions that I really couldn't answer for him, he had to know if I said, I can't tell you, that he needed to just leave it at that. And I would always be his protector. I used to tell them I was magic.
yeah.
But, you know, and, you know, at that age, to have to tell your child that, okay, daddy's going to go to court today, make sure you just look out. Don't stop to talk to anybody. You know, all the schools knew. So it's a really delicate thing. And just to protect outside the home, protect other children in case you know, so many people wanted to hurt my ex-husband or my husband at the time. Who do they get to? If they can't get to me because I'm divorced from him, they're going to go after my kids. Or even at the time, they were still, we were all still a family, not even knowing he was guilty, but people did want to lash out at my husband. What do you do? What do you tell them? How do they protect themselves? How do I protect them? It's a very delicate thing, but sharing with my son, he actually thanked me. And he was always protective of Jerry, his younger brother. So it sort of one fell into the other. Jerry didn't really have to know. He was too young to know, to really process it. He knew things were happening, but he had more of a psychosomatic reaction physically with, he had like choking episodes, which I had to, you know, make sure he was okay and deal with. But, you know, I did have somebody lash out at me. I don't even remember where it was, but they actually said, you know, that I should be in prison because I put my kids through all this. But, you know, everybody has a different view on things. When you don't know your husband's guilty and you're a family and you're trying to get through this, it's you navigate as you go. Nobody has a crystal ball unless you go to the gypsy on the corner in New York City, you know?
Right.
Like you can't figure this stuff out ahead of time unless we truly have that ESP. So, yeah, I mean, my kids, they had their own journey. You're right. They are. And that is another interview because, you know, they have Michael, my son, even helped me with a couple of scenes in the book where it was almost the book was just about done. And this, I haven't told anybody this, I'm telling you this right now, but the book was pretty much in its place. And I actually asked the publisher if I can add a piece to that because Michael, my older one, shared with me as things were happening, you know, with the book and all. He said, Mom, you know, I remember so clearly the last time I ever hugged my father. And I asked him, you know, Dad, are you coming home for Christmas? Are you going to be here for the holiday? And he said, sure, pal. Yeah, I'm going to be here. And, you know, he said he remembers. And I didn't even know that it occurred. These are things where they probably have a perspective where they have their own story within themselves to tell. Because I wasn't in their minds. I can only protect them the best I could. But they do have quite perspectives on this for sure.
Yes, it's a fascinating journey that you take the reader in. The Body Snatcher's Wife, My Life with a Monster. Thank you very much, Barbara Riefel, for this. It has been very, very eye-opening.
This is
a Post Hill Publishing book, and they can get this book from Amazon or anywhere else. Is there a website or Facebook page for this book at all?
Well, it's on my Facebook page. My son, Jerry, who is like a little guru, he's got it on my Instagram. He's got it on my Facebook page. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Anywhere where books are sold.
Absolutely.
It's Postal Press under the business of Simon & Schuster as well. So it's like it's a wonderful company. They're all amazing, and they really helped me with my story for sure. They really did.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Barbara Riefel, The Body Snatcher's Wife.
Thank you.
You have a great evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too.
Good night.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.